You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Chris Molina.
And I'm Jay Carlisle Larson. Coming up, we talk to a researcher who says our modern beauty ideals, including fat phobia, have deep roots in racism. We'll find out why.
First, it's time for our weekly state news roundup. We're checking in with reporters around Wisconsin about the stories they've been covering.
First, two state lawmakers from Milwaukee are introducing a bill that would allow red light traffic cameras to be installed at some of the city's most dangerous intersections. Traffic cameras aren't currently allowed under state law.
Corinne Hess is a reporter for WPR News based in Milwaukee. Corey, thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
So give us a sense as to how big of a problem reckless driving is in Milwaukee right now.
Actually, it's a pretty huge problem in Milwaukee. Right now, currently, reckless driving has caused about 20 serious injuries and 19 fatalities in Milwaukee this year. It's down from last year a little bit, but it's like I said, a big problem.
And so this bill that we're talking about would allow for red light cameras, which is currently not something permitted under state law. What can you tell us about how these cameras would work?
Well, what the city would like the state to pass is the ability to put red light cameras at about 50 of the most dangerous intersections, and it would take pictures of people's license plates, and then they would be sent tickets in the mail. They also want to put in speed enforcement cameras, and people driving 21 miles an hour over the speed limit would be also ticketed.
I was a little bit surprised to learn that we didn't have this already in Wisconsin. I know other states and other cities have experimented with these cameras in the past. Have these been successful elsewhere or not so much?
Well, it depends who you ask. A study done in 2017 by Case Western Reserve University found that they're successful in changing the types of accidents, so there's fewer T-bones, but and you know what I mean by a T-bone accident.
Been there.
But really, they don't reduce accidents, and they don't seem to reduce the number of people going through red lights.
So this bill was introduced by two Democratic representatives, David Crowley and Senator LaTanya Johnson. Can you just talk a little bit more about why they're saying that this bill is needed?
Well, I mean, they're saying it's needed just because of the number of reckless drivers in Milwaukee. Like I said, this is a problem in the city, and it has been for several years. The police department now does, they chase drivers that are recklessly driving, but that's not helped at all. We just had a police officer killed in the last few weeks. So they want to try to stop this.
And so this legislation is out now, just introduced. What's going to be the next step on this going forward?
Well, the deadline for co-sponsorship is July 9th, and then we'll see if it does move forward and if it gets much support.
Something tells me if there's a public comment period on this one, that is one that is going to receive a lot of commentary. Corey, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Corinne Hess is a WPR reporter based in Milwaukee. She was with us to talk about a bill that would allow red light traffic cameras at some of the city's most dangerous intersections. Now, moving to Spring Green, many residents are speaking out against a proposed facility that would breed dogs for medical research. Despite the outcry, local officials feel their options to deal with the project are limited. Lisa Speckhard-Pask is a Metro reporter for the Capital Times. Lisa, welcome back to Central Time.
Absolutely. Glad to be here.
So can you give us a sense of the scale and purpose of this operation that is being proposed in Spring Green?
Absolutely. So there's two parts of this proposal. One would be an indoor kennel in an old farm building, and that would house an average of about 135 dogs. That's according to the applicant's conditional use application. And then they would also have a separate kennel in their residential garage about 2 miles away, and that would be for mother female dogs and their puppies before they're weaned. So it's like a whelping facility.
It sounds like this operation has been in the works for a little bit, but when did this really get onto the radar of some concerned residents in Spring Green?
Yeah, so it kind of all exploded. On June 19th, there was a village meeting for one of the conditional use permits needed for this operation. And that's when it kind of, the publicity hit that this is for a medical, the dogs will be bred for medical research. A lot of people had ethical or moral objections to that. So protesters and opponents showed up at this meeting and voiced their concerns, ended up delaying that decision at the village meeting, and now it's continued to gain traction online. There's a petition going around that on Wednesday had about 9,000 signatures in opposition. I checked it this morning, it was 18,000, and then I checked it like an hour ago, and it's 19,000.
So anytime you're talking about a dog operation like this, some people are going to use the phrase puppy mill. Is that one of the concerns that we're hearing from concerned residents?
Yes, that term has been used a lot. And the Humane Society, you know, defines that as an inhumane commercial dog breeding facility where the health of the dogs is disregarded in for profits. While the conditional use application for this project describes a very humane and safe environment, but I think people are still using the term puppy mill to describe the fact that it is the dogs will be used for medical research.
What, if anything, have we heard from the owners of this business in response to all of these concerns?
Yeah, absolutely. They released a statement. You know, they said, we have our USDA license. We are inspected by the USDA. We've gone through all the proper permits. They've actually said that they have received some threats and that their car was vandalized through this experience. And they've said they're going to host a public forum to get the public to learn more and have pointed to resources that argue the benefits of using animals for medical research.
So it sounds like a decision was pushed off until next month. But even if town and county governments wanted to do something about this, potentially put a stop to it, what really do they have the capability to do?
Yeah, so it's tricky. So first of all, there's two different permits because some of this falls in the town and some of it in the village of Spring Green. But the larger issue here is that local officials have told me that they really feel like they can't reject it based on ethical or moral grounds because according to state law, for a conditional use permit, you can only reject it if it doesn't meet the conditions or the laid out expectations in the ordinance. And they said, well, we understand this is an emotional issue, but we can't make an emotional decision. So kind of in response to that, some residents and groups are petitioning for a local ordinance that would specifically ban this type of facility. So we'll see what happens there.
Well, Lisa, thanks for joining us today.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Lisa Speckard-Pask is a Metro reporter for the Capital Times, and she talked with us about backlash to a proposed facility in Spring Green that would breed dogs for medical research. Finally, we'll stay in southwestern Wisconsin, where the state's Public Service Commission held hearings this week on a proposed transmission line from the American Transmission Company and Dairyland Power Cooperative. Hope Kerwin is WPR's reporter based in La Crosse. Hope, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
So this is a big issue for the Driftless region, and there's been a lot of people organizing against this project. Can you give us an overview of the so-called Cardinal Hickory Creek line and the proposed routes in the area?
Yeah, so this is a high-voltage transmission line that, as you said, ATC, ITC Midwest, and Dairyland Power have proposed. Basically, it would stretch from the Madison area, just west of Madison, to Dubuque, Iowa area, basically cutting across Iowa County with a substation in Montfort and then through Grant County to Cassville, where it would then cross the Mississippi River.
And you went to one of the public hearings this week in Lancaster. What were you hearing from people who don't want to see this line get built?
Yeah, so there were a lot of people that turned out to oppose the Cardinal Hickory Creek project and just really voiced their concerns about it. The biggest impacts that people talked about were definitely just how this line would kind of change the landscape. You know, this cutting through right through the heart of the Driftless area, which is known for its very scenic hills and valleys. And, you know, they're worried how this could impact tourism and local property values. They also questioned a lot of questions about whether this project is needed. You know, they said that they don't think that there is the data to support that there's going to be more power consumption and really kind of the cause behind this line.
And it seems like both sides of the issue might be using this idea of renewable energy as a talking point. Can you talk about how that's being used on both sides to possibly justify this project?
Yeah, so I mean, renewable energy use is definitely as you said, been talked about on both sides. I mean, the utility companies and also groups like the Clean Grid Alliance say this infrastructure is needed to continue to see wind and solar projects pop up and really support the use of that energy. But some people on the opposite side, you know, argue that we should be focusing on homegrown wind and solar produced in the Driftless area itself to power local homes.
So the public comment period for the proposal ends today. What is the next step in determining whether or not this gets approved?
So the PSC, I believe, has until the end of September to approve or deny the application. But regulators in Iowa also have to approve the section in Iowa for this project as well. So as soon as that kind of process goes forward, ATC and their partners estimate that they could see the line in service by 2023.
Well, Hope, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Hope Kerwin is a WPR reporter based in La Crosse. She talked with us about this week's public hearings on a proposed transmission line in southwestern Wisconsin. In full disclosure, the American Transmission Company is a WPR sponsor.
Coming up, our guest says many elements of fat phobia are actually rooted in racism. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Jay Carlisle-Larson.
And I'm Chris Molina. Coming up, with the first Democratic debates of the presidential season behind us, we'll recap the highlights and talk about what's changed in the race to become the Democratic nominee.
First, European and North American beauty standards have been overwhelmingly white and thin for centuries, and fat phobia is ingrained in many of us from an early age.
Our next guest says that the ideas of who is considered to be beautiful and the rejection of larger, curvier women's bodies are deeply rooted in racism.
Sabrina Strings is an assistant professor of sociology at the University of California, Irvine. She is the author of Fearing the Black Body, The Racial Origins of Fat Phobia. Sabrina, welcome to Central Time.
It's great to be on with you.
So it seems like a lot of the issues that you deal with in your book have their roots in quotes, race science promoted in the 18th century. Can you briefly explain what those theories were and what they were meant to justify?
Yes. So when we look at what was happening in the 18th century, people may be aware of the fact that this was the height of the slave trade, the transatlantic slave trade, that is. And in the beginning, in the early days of the slave trade, skin color was usually the measure that was utilized to determine who was slave and who was free. But over time, as you might imagine, due to interracial sex, skin color became sort of unmanageable as a mechanism for determining who should have the access to and privileges of freedom. And one of the things that they decided, that race scientists decided, was that they wanted to consider the behaviors and also other physical features that would lead people to identify an individual as black. And within that conception, eating, which was considered one of the animal indulgences, and also fatness were deemed to be evidence of blackness.
And we see this a fair amount in some of the anxieties that show up in writings at the time. In your book, you write about this article that showed up. There's no author, but it was called Actually Starving. A prominent New York man dies inside of food. Can you talk about the way that this anxiety manifested itself in, you know, everyday conversation?
Yes. And actually, at that time in the late 19th century in the United States, there was this great terror that Americans were actually too slender. What happened was that the theories that were coming out of race science actually proved to be quite successful in convincing Europeans that in order to prove that they were part of the elite race, they needed to limit how much food they ate and then also maintain slender physiques. So that by the late 19th century in the United States, a lot of Americans were excessively slender. Dieting was a massive fad. And it wasn't until around the early 20th century when more medical doctors were getting involved with the issue, and they were trying to reform the American physique by getting women in particular to gain more weight. This is counterintuitive, given what we now think about the relationship between weight and health.
And in that vein, because this is such a broad topic and the roots of your work go back to the sort of pseudoscience of race science and how it has manifested itself to back then, to health, and today in health. When you first decided to look into this topic, what kind of reaction did you get?
That's a great question, because surprisingly, for me at least, people were very resistant to the very idea of my studying this. I was told that this work either could not be known, which is why no one else had written a book about it, that everything about the topic that could be known was known. As recently as 2013, a scholar in the field of public health at a prestigious university told me that my work was, quote, dangerous. So it's only been within the past 5 years that people have been interested in even thinking about the relationship between fat phobia and anti-blackness.
We're talking to Sabrina Strings right now. She's an assistant professor of sociology at the University of California, Irvine. She's the author of the book, Fearing the Black Body, The Racial Origins of Fat Phobia. And we're talking about that intersection of race, of health, and history here. And, you know, again, your book goes really in depth. And I want to point out the story of Sarah Bartman, and she, this story illustrates the intersection of this, the way the anxieties of the black body manifested themselves with white audiences. Can you tell us about her?
Absolutely. She was born in Cape Town, South Africa in the late 18th century. And at the time, that was a British colony. She was actually a slave, and her owner was a black man. He would take her to various ports where soldiers in infirmaries would be stationed, and she would perform little dances for them, almost like stripteases. And it was after she had been doing this for a time that a British entrepreneur saw her and thought, I can make a mint if I can only get her to Europe. So he bought her from her slaver, took her to first London and then Paris, and she was put on display specifically as a perfect specimen of Africanity. She was supposed to represent not only the iconic ideal of black femininity, but also the barbarity, the savagery of Africans because of her proportions. She had thick thighs, so-called protruding buttocks, a fleshy stomach, and, you know, curvaceousness in general. And therefore, people believed that there was something about her largesse that bespoke a certain type of Africanness.
And what were the audience's reactions at the time? Because the story of Sarah Bartman has, you know, persisted until today.
That's right. And most of what we hear about her has to do, again, with her buttocks, or sometimes also conversations surrounding her genitalia, which were also prominently displayed. But at the time when she was on display there, for many in London and also in Paris, they had never actually seen a black woman. So we think about the way the transatlantic slave trade worked. They would take black people from Africa and then bring them to various colonies, but rarely did they actually make it to the European mainland. So when people came out to see her, many of them would have been appalled, sometimes because they expected to see a voluptuous woman and they saw one, sometimes because they expected to see a voluptuous woman and they did not see one. But I hope that you understand where I'm going with this, yeah. Which is that there was such a mythology surrounding her proportions that people either came and found that, oh, yes, indeed, she is just as big as they said, or they had this understanding of what she was going to look like that did not in any way match reality, and they were disappointed that she wasn't even bigger. So yes, for a lot of people in Europe at the time who had the opportunity to see our exhibition, they either had their racial ideas confirmed or were completely confused about why a quote slender Venus was being used to represent blackness.
We're talking about just now about how European, white Europeans reacted, but this was not just specific to Europe. We had this in America as well, largely because of our history with slavery, as we got into a little bit earlier. How did this progress once we got outside of the 19th century into the 20th century?
Yes, as I mentioned earlier, in the 19th century in the United States, the racial discourse was actually quite powerful. And many Americans, many white Americans, did decide that they were going to take up dieting and also attempts to be slender as evidence of racial and also religious propriety. So that by the early 20th century, what we had was a number of doctors sort of puzzling over this whole question of why are so many Americans this slender? And an individual by the name of John Harvey Kellogg, who we remember now as a purveyor of fine breakfast cereals, but was also a Seventh-day Adventist and a physician. And he thought it was very important for us to figure out how to get white American women to gain weight because they are the front line for the new generation. And therefore, we need to increase their strength, increase their vigor, and actually get them to eat more of the right foods so that they can gain enough flesh to reproduce the nation.
That reproduction of the nation, I think, is part of the anxiety that we hear a lot at this time. And I want to jump ahead because there was pushback among black women in the 60s. Can you talk about the Black is Beautiful movement and what they tried to address?
The interesting thing in my research was that a lot of the writing about blackness and fatness was actually being written by Europeans and for Europeans. As you might imagine, for a lot of the history of these writings, black people were enslaved and illiterate, and so they didn't really have access to these conversations. So when I looked into black newspapers, I found that there wasn't a whole lot of information about aesthetics and particularly about body size. And it wasn't until the 1960s and 1970s in which there was this real movement to reclaim black features as beautiful that we start to see now more black women and men trying to reframe what beauty can be for African Americans. And part of that conversation was to say that we actually do prize women who are more voluptuous and more curvaceous.
In closing, we have about a minute left. We've taken a big, long view at this. What do you want people to know today about how this keeps going?
I think it is important for people to be aware of the fact that fat phobia is actually not rooted in health concerns as it's commonly presented. Historically, it is rooted in race science and also Protestantism. And by knowing this, we can take a more compassionate approach to trying to address what are the factors that are contributing to poor health outcomes for fat people.
Sabrina, thank you so much for joining us today. This was a fascinating read.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Sabrina Strings is an assistant professor of sociology at the University of California, Irvine. She was with us to talk about her new book, Fearing the Black Body, The Racial Origins of Fat Phobia.
Coming up, Democratic presidential candidates got their first chance to debate each other head-on over the last couple of nights. We'll discuss their different policy positions and other big moments from the first two debates. I'm Chris Molina.
And I'm Jay Carlisle Larson. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson.
And I'm Chris Molina. Coming up Monday after 7 on The Morning Show, the head of the State Department of Corrections joins Kate Archer Kent to talk about alcohol issues, staff pay, and more. That's Monday after 7 on the Ideas Network.
Now, after back-to-back nights with 20 candidates, the first Democratic presidential debates are over.
For a lot of contenders, the debate was a chance to introduce themselves to voters.
But for others, it was a shot at knocking their opponents off their game and convincing voters that they're the best person to take on President Trump in 2020.
Susan Johnson is an associate professor of political science at UW-Whitewater, and she joins us now to talk about the debates. Susan, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me.
So I want to start with the moment that a lot of people are talking about after last night. This is Senator Kamala Harris pushing Vice President Joe Biden, former Vice President Joe Biden, on his position on integrating schools by busing students.
To hear you talk about the reputations of two United States senators who built their reputations and career on the segregation of race in this country. And it was not only that, but you also worked with them to oppose busing. And, you know, there was a little girl in California who was part of the second class to integrate her public schools. And she was bused to school every day. And that little girl was me.
And that's just part of a broader exchange that Senator Harris had with the former vice president. And I think, Susan, that some people expected a little pot shot here and there. Did we expect anything like this back and forth from last night's?
Well, I think in regard to that specific clip that you just played in that issue, and then thinking more broadly about the debate last night, there was more than what we saw on Wednesday in terms of some of that, you know, kind of going very directly at the candidates. And I think the most notable moment was the clip that you just played where Kamala Harris went at Vice President Joe Biden and challenged him on some of the positions he held early on in his career, and then also some of the explanations he's made since then, and then again some of the more recent comments. And I think that in addition to wanting to bring that issue to the fore, there's also an attempt to show a generational divide, I would say, amongst the different candidates across the stage both nights.
Yeah, and we had one candidate, you know, kind of making reference to that, saying, hey, Joe Biden said it was time to pass the torch 30 years ago, and Biden saying, hey, I'm still holding the torch. And on this particular exchange, you know, we could look at it as it was an isolated thing between the former vice president and Senator Kamala Harris. But could we also look at it as, hey, here are the two very distinct portions of the Democratic Party right now, and they're kind of fighting to really capture the soul of the party at this point?
Well, I think that across the two dozen or so candidates who are running and the 20 who were on the stage, there's a broad range of positions, all within the Democratic policy, obviously, but ranging from, you know, more moderate to more liberal. And so we're just seeing that play out. I think that, again, we're also seeing what kinds of issues each candidate wants to focus their campaign on and make the centerpiece of their campaign moving forward.
I want to take a listen to a little bit more of that exchange. And here's the former vice president's response.
Everything I've done in my career, I ran because of civil rights. I continue to think we have to make fundamental changes in civil rights. And those civil rights, by the way, include not just only African-Americans, but the LGBT community.
But Vice President Biden, do you agree today that you were wrong to oppose busing in America then?
No,
do you agree?
I did not oppose busing in America. What I opposed is busing ordered by the Department of Education. That's what I oppose.
So former Vice President Joe Biden really came into these debates widely seen as the front runner in this race. And when you're the front runner in the debates, you don't want to say anything that's going to get you in trouble. But you also know that people may come after you. If you're the former vice president, how do you proceed after last night?
Well, I mean, I think that what his staff and he have to do is be more prepared to answer those types of questions moving forward in the next debate. But even before that, I mean, for example, today Vice President Biden is speaking at an event for Operation Push with Jesse Jackson, and he addressed the issue, speaking broadly about his support for civil rights and his support for and the support from the African-American community throughout his long career. So I think that the immediate attempt to bounce back is to refute some of the criticisms he's getting as a result of some of those comments and try to shift the narrative a bit so that we're not talking about it as much as I guess we're talking about it.
Were there other points in the debate where Biden perhaps was a little bit better? Were there high points for him that perhaps are now overshadowed by this exchange with Senator Harris?
You know, I think that's hard to say. I didn't necessarily see any particular high points. One of the high points in an exchange with Senator Harris that I thought was a good comeback for Senator Biden was when he made the comment that when he went into practicing law, he chose to be a public defender and she chose to be a prosecutor. And I think he was trying to send a message there. I think that I didn't find him to be particularly well prepared to answer a lot of the questions. So I think that maybe when he was defending the work that he and President Obama had done, I think that might have been some of his stronger points.
We're talking right now with Susan Johnson. She is an associate professor of political science at UW-Whitewater. And we are talking about the two Democratic debates that took place this week. And Susan, we've talked so far about the debate that happened last night. We also need to remember that there was one that happened the previous night. And that one featured Elizabeth Warren, who, you know, some think she had a little bit of a luck of the draw here. You know, she was in a debate without the other two perceived frontrunners, Senator Bernie Sanders and former Vice President Joe Biden. And what did you make of Elizabeth Warren's performance on Wednesday night?
You know, I think she went in with some high expectations because she was on the stage with the candidates that were perceived to be, many of them, second-tier candidates. And I thought she did quite well. I thought she held her own. I thought that she was able to clearly articulate, as she's been able to do throughout the campaign, clearly articulate well-defined policy positions in a number of different areas. So I think that the only place she could have gone was, you know, I mean, to show poorly, and she obviously didn't do that.
The other front runner that we haven't talked about so much yet is Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders. Now, Bernie caused quite a stir when he jumped into the race in 2016 in his push to push the party further to the left. He's now one of several candidates this year who's trying to do that same thing. So looking at his debate performance last night, did he do enough to really convince the progressive voters in the Democratic Party that he's still the one to carry the torch on this?
Yeah, that's an interesting question, Chris. One of the analyses of the debate that I read, Winners and Losers, it said that a winner was Bernie Sanders' ideas, but a loser was Bernie Sanders.
Mm.
And, you know, I think what was meant by that is that in 2016, Bernie Sanders, he owned the left. And when he was running against Clinton, she was seen as a pragmatic, more moderate Democratic candidate. And he was able to mobilize the left of the Democratic Party, and he was the only one speaking about a lot of the issues, Medicare for All, for example. There are other things that are seen to be much more on the left of the Democratic Party. And what's happened is that a lot of people since then have adopted his ideas, and they're not necessarily as fresh, or I would argue maybe even necessarily as controversial, as they were 4 years ago. And so now he's not the only person out there advocating for some of these things. And as a result, I don't know that he's going to be the most supported person carrying that message moving forward.
As we said, there were 20 candidates who took the stage over the last two nights. There were a couple of candidates who didn't make it. And we've talked a lot about the people that we do know. Let's talk about some of the ones who America may have been introduced to last night and the night before. Who do you think out of the lesser-known candidates really took advantage of that position on the debate stage?
I think I would go back to the first debate, and I would say, for example, Julian Castro, who had been in President Obama's cabinet and was able to, again, well articulate positions, particularly on immigration, but on other things as well, that I think people were wondering, who is this? And, you know, doing searches to try to figure out more about him. I think Cory Booker, senator from New Jersey, is someone who has been trying to break into that next tier, and I think that he did well on that first night. And I think last night, I don't know where Mayor Pete Buttigieg, you know, ranks in terms of top tier or not, but I think he held his own last night. I think that for a lot of people who were watching, myself included, at the beginning, I was trying to make sense of, I didn't recognize everyone. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. To be honest. And I was trying to, you know, make sure I knew who all was up there. And I think that was the case for a lot of people who were watching.
Before we move on and talk about a couple of specific issues, I want to ask you this question, Susan. We did a debate preview segment, and I asked this question to the guest as well, and I'm interested with these debates that happened over the last two nights, who the audience was for them. Is the audience undecided voters, Democrats, or are they the people with money out there who might be wondering where they're going to get the best bang for their buck?
You mean who are the candidates speaking to?
Yeah, who are they speaking to? Who are they really trying to reach during these debates?
Well, I think that they're trying to range a multitude of people. I think that absolutely they're trying to reach voters because it's, you know, it's really important that they are able to register higher in the polls as the threshold goes up for access to these debates. At the same time, if those same people are sending them even a little bit of money, or if high price donors are willing to give them money. I think that that's key. And I think another group that they're playing to is the media. And because we're here talking about winners and losers, every network did a winners and losers analysis. And that is something that, you know, people pay attention to. And voters pay attention to that as well. So I think that there's a bit with, and I think that that plays out particularly with the different kinds of buzz lines or taglines that candidates try to get out there to make sure that as we talk about it, as newscasts talk about it, as Twitter talks about things, that some of those sound bites get attention and will help hopefully for them raise their profile.
I'm wondering too, you know, we've talked about who had good debate performances, and, you know, some media, like you've said, have gone to the extra step to saying these are the winners and losers. Do we have to be a little bit careful as media members in the language that we use so as we're not making up minds for voters?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that that's very important, and I think that that's just part and parcel. It's hard to do analysis without talking about strengths and weaknesses, mm-hmm. right? And so I don't think necessarily people are trying to do a disservice to one or the other. Clearly, some did better than others, but it's just one debate, and it's very early, and most people had just a few minutes to speak on that stage. So I would caution from making too many assumptions or judgments just based on one debate.
We're talking right now with Susan Johnson of UW-Whitewater about the first Democratic debate that wrapped up after its second night yesterday.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Did you tune in for the debates? Who stood out to you? Did your opinion change about any of the candidates? And what did you think about the different positions you heard from them on issues like immigration or health care? If you didn't watch, call in and tell us why at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org.
We'll continue this conversation after a short break. Stay with us here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Chris Molina.
And I'm Jay Carlisle-Larson. Right now, we continue our conversation about the last two nights of Democratic debates with Susan Johnson. She's Associate Professor of Political Science at UW-Whitewater.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What did you wish you saw more of from the candidates over both nights? Do you feel like they missed any issues that are important to you? If you think you'll be voting in the first Democratic primary, which candidates did you like the most? And if you think you'll be voting on the Republican side of the ticket, what do you think of what you heard? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or tweet us at CentralTimeWPR. We'll go to the phones now, and Steve is with us in Sun Prairie. Hi, Steve.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
You bet. Go ahead.
Yeah, you know, I watched both debates, and it's pretty obvious that it just seems like they're running more for Santa Claus than they are running for president. And the TDS, the Trump Derangement Syndrome, is still at an all-time high. How do they expect to get, you know, people like me who don't necessarily like Trump, but, you know, I don't want to go down a socialist path, and I want to deal with people that are normal.
Steve, thank you so much for that call. And that was something that came up in the debate last night, Susan, especially in terms of Bernie Sanders, you know, whether or not the country might be ready for a candidate who's wearing that label socialist. If we are going forward with a candidate like this, is that something that there's some thinking that might play right into the Republicans' hands and might be an advantage to President Trump?
Well, I think a lot of Democrats who are not Bernie Sanders and who don't identify as Democratic Socialists are, eager to make that claim. I think Steve brings up a good point. What happens during the nomination phase, and the same thing would have happened in 2016 with the Republicans, when there's a lot of candidates running, they're trying to distinguish themselves from each other. And last night and the night before, there was a lot of crosstalk, a lot of cutting people off, a lot of pointed comments, and I think that was because different people were just trying to get the attention of the moderators, of the audience, and, you know, everyone who was watching. And so they're not the most staid events, I would argue. And I think that what we need to do is, you know, wait as these things, as the numbers of candidates start to get smaller, and I'm hoping that will lead to more civilized and more detailed discussions of the policy nuances.
Steve, thank you so much for the call. We'll go next to Terry in Genoa. Hi, Terry.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
You bet. Go ahead.
Yeah, so I'm still kind of catching up on the debates. I've got a little one at home, so, you know, finding the time. But I'm almost to the end of the first debate, and I was quite surprised. Julian Castro, I didn't know much about him, and he really stood out. And Beto O'Rourke stood out to me as well. I found him to be very articulate and passionate, and I'm looking forward to seeing what the next debate brings.
Terry, thank you so much for that call. So Terry is a perfect example, Susan, of the kind of people that candidates like Julian Castro are trying to reach because, you know, by and large, I would think that Democrats haven't quite made up their minds yet because they don't necessarily know who these people are.
Of course. And some of the candidates that are polling very high are polling that way. A lot of it is name recognition. And so what we should be seeing happening now, I'll be curious when some of the polls come out after the debate to see who's moved up or down. And someone like Julian Castro, I mean, I agree with Terry that I think he stood out. I would expect to see his poll numbers increase. I would expect his number of donors to increase as well. And so he might be someone that might get a little bit more traction. But again, it's so early in the process that we're still in the sort of sifting and winnowing stage. And I want to see more moving forward.
Terry, thank you so much for that call. We are talking with Susan Johnson. She's an associate professor of political science at UW-Whitewater, and we are talking about the Democratic debates that happened this week. And one of the big issues in last night's debate, and the one on Wednesday as well, was health care. Let's take a listen to this clip of NBC's Lester Holt asking the candidates about this.
Many people watching at home have health insurance coverage through their employer. Who here would abolish their private health insurance in favor of a government-run plan? Just a show of hands to start off with.
And so they did this on both nights, and only four candidates raised their hands. But it looks like healthcare, just judging by the amount of time that it got in both of these debates, is going to be shaping up to be one of the big issues of this election. How important is this going to be for Democrats as they campaign going forward?
Well, I think this is a key issue. In 2018, it was one of the issues that resonated with voters more than most others. And I expect that we're going to have Democratic candidates talking a lot about health care. I mean, health care costs continue to go up. There's issues with access to health care, prescription drug costs. I mean, all sorts of things across the board that can be discussed when it comes to health care. And this is an area where we saw a lot of difference over the two nights in regard to people's positions. And I expect that, again, as we get deeper into this nomination process, we're going to see more of those nuances come out.
One other thing I want to talk about before we have to wrap up is the role of women up there on stage. And I want to go back to Wednesday when Washington Governor Jay Inslee made a comment about being the only candidate to have passed a law protecting a woman's right to reproductive health and health insurance. And that got a response from Senator Amy Klobuchar. Let's take a listen.
I just want to say there's three women up here that have fought pretty hard for a woman's right to choose. I'll start with that.
And that was probably one of the lines that got the biggest applause from the audience during the two nights. But, Susan, it's certainly worth noticing that we saw a record number of women over the last couple of nights. What's the significance of that?
Well, I think that it's very important. It was women. It was minority candidates. And it showed, you know, diversity that we have not seen. And I think that shows that the Democratic Party is interested in promoting different people, again, different women and minority candidates, and there's a lot of interest in having a diverse field.
We got an email from Johan who emails, can we all agree, stop name-calling, stop bullying, just tell me what your plans are and how you plan on doing it. And that kind of echoes something that Senator Kamala Harris said when she said, let's not have a food fight, let's talk about how we're going to put food on people's tables. So, Susan, are we going to see a civil campaign going forward? Are we going to get what Johan is talking about here? No name-calling, no bullying?
I hope so. I can't make any promises. I think that last night, what we saw with a lot of the crosstalk and cutting people off and interruptions, I think that was because people were trying to get their voice heard. I found it a bit disconcerting, and I was wishing that they would have shut the mics down at some point, because maybe that would have kept more civility, because I didn't know that was the best representation of the Democratic Party.
I think they tried the mics off trick on night one, and it didn't go so well.
Yeah.
Well, there's my political humor for the day, and we'll leave it there. Susan, thank you so much for joining us today.
You're welcome.
That was Susan Johnson, Associate Professor of Political Science at UW-Whitewater. She was with us today to recap what we saw over the last two nights of the Democratic debates.
Coming up Monday on Central Time, while the Democratic debates are over, for now, a lot of candidates tried to make their mark with their platforms. And as we mentioned, one of the biggest was health care, notably the idea of ditching private insurance for a public model. We'll talk more about that next week.
With low housing stock and rising prices, some cities are starting to rethink single-family zoning, but not everyone is on board. We'll look at the growing debate over zoning restrictions in the United States.
And as more and more retail stores go out of business, we'll talk to an expert who says it's getting harder to shop local, and that could be a big issue for people across the state.
Stay with us on Central Time.